Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock, and welcome to Vox Pop on this Food Friday, April 24th. I'm Ray Graff. Today we welcome back Shannon Hayes, chef and co-owner of Sap Bush Hollow Farm and Cafe, a three-generation pasture-based livestock farm and farm-to-table cafe located in Schoharie County. She's the author of several books, the host of the Hearth of Sap Bush Hollow podcast, chronicles and lessons from a life tied to family, community, and the land. She is a great, thoughtful guest. Always good to have her on the show. The number here is 800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. Email, if you wish, voxpop@wamc.org. Shannon Hayes and your calls coming up after the news. Hello again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. It's Food Friday, and we welcome back Shannon Hayes today, chef and CEO owner of Sap Bush Hollow Farm Cafe, a three-generation pasture-based livestock farm and farm-to-table cafe located in Schoharie County, armed with a PhD in sustainable ag and community development from Cornell University. Shannon is one of the nation's leading experts in cooking grass-fed and pastured meats. She's the host of the Hearth of Sap Bush Hollow podcast, chronicles and lessons from a life tied to family, community, and the land. She's also written a few books. You want to give us a call now? Maybe you're a fan of the Sap Bush Hollow Farm Cafe? 800-348-2551 is the number. 1-800-348-2551. You can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. Shannon Hayes, welcome back. How are you?
Oh, Ray, it's so nice to see you. I'm doing really well.
How's the farm?
You know, I'm looking for wood to knock on, but I think things are going pretty well right now. I was thinking about that this morning, and I was thinking, well, we got one freezer broken, and half the electricity in the cafe is not working, so we got to get rewired.
Man.
And I'm like, only two things broken? This is incredible. We are in great shape. We hold the whole place together with baling twine and duct tape, and you realize, wow, if only two things are broken, we are ready to go
for
the season.
Are you really, truly this optimistic?
You know what? Yeah.
Really?
And I know, because the world's, and I was thinking about that on the drive in. This is great work. And I have to reduce my doom scrolling. And I will admit that you're seeing me right now and listening to me right now as someone who has been on a very strict phone diet. So I do not doom scroll a lot, which could be why I'm thinking things are looking pretty great. I'm aware of what's going on, but I also think the livelihood is just so uplifting. I'm working with my father and my husband and my kids, and there's plenty to eat. There's lots of good work to do, and the customers are fantastic people. So yeah, it is great.
Oh, you know what? You're uplifting me right now. I'm usually, glass less than half empty sort of fella. All right, so the cafe open yet? Not yet.
No, the cafe is going to open the Saturday of Memorial Day weekend, May 23rd. We are getting through lambing season and farrowing season before we open. As I age, I'm starting to learn to reduce the stresses. So we focus when lambing season and farrowing season is on, which is right now. It's all hands on deck, and it can be beautiful, but it can also be terrible, and it can be dangerous.
Why can it be terrible and dangerous?
Well, sows are over 500 pounds.
Really?
And when they drop their piglets, you want to know how those piglets are doing. As Dad always says, look from afar and then run. I mean, they're omnivores. They've got, big jaws. They could leave nothing but your shoe buckles, as my mother used to say, if you get caught. They're protective. So you want to be rested. You want to be thinking your best if there's a problem out there. And, we talk about births. We're going to drop probably, we'll have about, 160 lambs and about 30 piglets will drop on the ground in the next 4 weeks. And you'll have great uplifting births where things are beautiful, but then you'll also have, complications that happen, deaths that happen. So it's intense.
What does it mean to you to be so tied to the circle of life, the cycle of life and the land, and make your life out of that?
I think it's what enables me to come in here at the top of the hour and you say, how are you doing? And the world is where it's at right now. And I'm like, yeah, it's pretty good.
Well, you know what? It does keep you separated, especially if you're not going to do too much digital scrolling.
I'll argue it doesn't keep me separated. It keeps me deeply integrated.
I love that answer. Now, listen, I've never really talked to you about the books you've written.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to talk about that. But I was putting the very simple page together for today's show, and I realized that some 17 years ago, you were doing commentaries on this radio station. Alas, we had a web host change, and it was botched. And I won't say by who, but it's a three-letter organization, and we sometimes play their programming most often. Anyway, they host our website now, and we lost all this audio and stuff from anything from before 2012 is gone. You did a commentary in 2009 entitled "What Makes the Butcher Sexy?" There's no content on the page. I got to know what makes the butcher sexy.
Well, I have to admit to you that I've written several hundred essays like that. That has been my primary writing form. WAMC actually got me started there.
You're welcome.
So to remember one of several hundred is a little bit challenging.
Oh, so you don't even know.
So I'm just going to freewheel it and I'm going to tell you.
All right.
I do actually remember that conversation because it was happening at the time of Julie and Julia. Remember when that book came out and that movie came out? And
right.
Then that author went on and she wrote Chopped and she got into butchering. And the New York Times was all of a sudden we farmers and butchers, we had our heyday. And everyone thought we were really cool. People wanted to actually learn it until they learned out, you know, what we got paid. And and everyone was talking about butchers like it was for like 5 minutes in all of our history here. It was a sexy career. My dad decided long ago, he noticed I really liked food. And we started doing on-farm butchering and he threw me in with the butchers. And so I am not really big enough to be lifting sides of carcasses and to be operating the stuff. But I had to learn to do the small cutting, the fine cutting, and I had to learn how to boss them around and to make sure that our cuts came out the way we wanted
yeah.
them to. And it was pretty awful sometimes. Like I said, they spoke Mannese. They spoke in one-syllable words, and they had a code, and they didn't know how to communicate that to me. And but as we started to build a relationship together— first of all, I learned the subtext of Mannese, where we express care and communication for each other, like watching out for each other, keeping each other safe. But then I also started recognizing the level of manual competence that is required to make this job work. You don't just have to know all the cuts of an animal, which very few people do know. They don't know where their food is coming from. You have to have an understanding of the farming practices that came in the door that create the physique, the conditioning of the animal that you're looking at. You also have to be able to have all these mechanical skills. You got to be strong. You got to be able to break things down. You have to be smart with your body because it's got to serve you on your feet for the next 30 or 40 year career. And you have to be frugal because no one's going to pay you a lot for this work. And so these features, I realized, they made for a sexy guy. I mean, they can make for a sexy woman too, but look, he can live within his means. He can fix stuff when it breaks. He knows good food. He can figure out what was going on before that animal came in. Compassionate, because believe it or not, when animals aren't compassionately cared for, it impacts the quality of the meat.
I've heard it.
Yeah.
And hold that thought mm-hmm. because I want to find out why, if yep. you know why. You know, you've learned a lot. Was your dad tough to work with? Is he tough to?
He never came into the cutting room.
No,
he stayed out. No, I had to work with. He threw me in there.
Really?
Yeah, he right. totally threw me. He just absolved himself of that. Dad deals with him alive. He's the master animal scientist. He's another PhD too.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay, so let me ask about PhDs. And our guest today is Shannon Hayes, a CEO owner of Sapbush Hollow Farm Cafe in the lovely Schoharie County. 800-348-2551. A life question for Shannon Hayes. You have a PhD. Dad has a PhD. Yours is in sustainable ag and community development. Cornell.
Mm-hmm.
That's pretty swanky. Do you learn more on the farm than you ever did with books and in school?
Well, interestingly, after I finished my PhD, I traveled around for some of my book research. You said you wanted to talk about that. We can get that later. And I did start to recognize that I was coming up against a lot of people, not against, I was meeting with a lot of people who had even dropped out of high school who I felt were more educated than I was. And I started to realize that degrees have very little to do with education, but sometimes we have to pursue degrees until we can learn how to be an independent learner. And I've often felt the PhD, I had to do hard work. I had to do original research. That is genuinely true. And I had to learn how to learn. It took me an associate's, a bachelor's, a master's, and a PhD to learn how to be a self-directed learner. So sometimes I joke that the PhD is a sign that it took me that long to figure things out. Other people figured out much faster.
Well, what's the secret? You're talking to a refrigerator bulb dim individual here. How do you learn to learn?
How do you learn to learn? First, you learn to nurture your curiosity. Then you learn to be comfortable with not knowing. And I think sometimes PhDs fall on their faces there because we think we do have to know. But you can't discover new information. You don't have the serendipitous discovery of the aha if you can't be comfortable with not knowing something. I think a lot of times when people go on for higher education, they learn all the facts of their trade. They learn all the facts that they're supposed to know. And they feel like they're supposed to contribute to that by knowing a lot already. But I learned it's the serendipitous moment when you suspend and go, wow, I've got a hot mess here of all bunch of information coming in and I don't know how to make sense of any of it. And that's where breakthroughs happen. So that's how I learned how to learn, to be comfortable with not knowing.
So humility is part of it.
And vulnerability.
Interesting. Yeah. You know what? We haven't even talked about food yet, but let's take a break. Shannon Hayes is our guest. Oh, whenever she's on, I feel pretty stupid. But you know what? This is just going to be fine. Give us a call, 800-348-2551, voxpop@wamc.org. Back in a flash. The great Milt Jackson. If you could see me now here on Vox Pop, it's a Food Friday. Ray Graff with you. 800-348-2551 is our number. Our guest is Shannon Hayes. We're going to get to the phones in a minute, but quickly, tell me about these books. You wrote, what, three books, four books?
I think.
More?
I think it might be six. It might be seven. I'm not.
Where do you find the time?
Yeah, that's a great question because I've been looking for it. If you find it, could you, like, share that with me?
Yeah,
yeah. I discovered my creative hours. And so I get up at like 3 or 4 in the morning. And that I also learned as part of my PhD. I figured out when to work. But I think the farm work has always balanced it for me. But I would give, while my kids were little, I would work from about 3 until 7 in the morning and devoted work. I mean, a lot of people say I lived like a monk. Now I'm playing more jazz, so it's a little bit harder to get up at 3 in the morning.
Playing the Barry Sax. How's that working out for you?
Oh, it makes me so happy. It's another whole life for me.
Does it annoy the animals?
Dad says it sounds like a foghorn, and we've been trying to figure out how to write it off. And some people say I could write off a Barry Sax as a farm expense if I could call the sheep, but they don't respond to it.
Well, maybe an alto, although I'm not that keen on the alto.
Do you know that if you go to any farm that's been around for a long time, the farmers have a song, and the song is handed down that you use to call your livestock. And different farms have different songs, and you find out it came from whoever was there beforehand. But we actually have a song that we call our sheep to. And I learned it from Dad, and Bob's my husband, we all do it, and my daughters do it. And then, you know, we all learn the song, and that's how you call your sheep.
And what's the song?
Let's go, let's go, come on, come on, let's go. But every farm has its own song.
Now, we should try an experiment next time.
Oh, hold that out to the sheep.
Yes, crank the radio up at the farm and see if they come to the radio.
But, you know, they know generation to generation to generation that that's the song. It's time to come down the hill and into the barn.
All right, Shannon Hayes of Sapbush Hollow Farm Cafe. again, we digress, and we haven't talked about your books. Just give us a quick précis of some of the subjects, and then we'll hit the phones.
Okay. I actually started out writing commentaries for WAMC.
Right. I've heard of them.
They were a great organization to work with. And I'm going to tell you, since you lost all your content, that it was probably like the best stuff you ever had.
Probably. Yeah. So I figured.
And while I was writing for you guys, I was thinking a lot about connecting people with their food. It was, 17 years ago, people were not thinking about food in terms of animals. They were thinking of food, like if they thought of chicken, they either thought of chicken breasts or chicken thighs. If they thought of beef, they thought of hamburger, they thought of steak. They didn't think of a whole animal. But I was part of a movement that was, recognizing the importance of developing a local, sustainable food system. And if people weren't in touch with the food and the farm and understanding the animals, then they weren't going to shift into that system. So I actually started writing because I realized even though WAMC let me have commentaries, people weren't going to listen to me unless I gave them recipes. So I started writing meat cookbooks, and I would use the recipes as a way to I would subversely like stick in little essays about how to understand if a farm is healthy, how to look at the ecosystem, how to, understand if an animal is healthy. And so I began building myself as a writer by using cookbooks, since not everybody was as nice to me as WAMC was.
Are you more fulfilled writing or working on the farm with your hands?
Yes.
Okay, fair enough. 800-34 I get it. 800-348-2551 is the number. Shannon Hayes joins us today. And, Matt Strauss was on last week from Heirloom Lodge over in Housatonic, Massachusetts. And he's a deep thinker on food issues and a great chef. And he made a comment, and it alluded to something you spoke of earlier, that these days, it's tough for people who are restaurateurs to know where that meat is coming from.
Yes.
And to him, that was a really important thing. Where you are, you know all so well where that meat is coming from. Is that important?
It is very important. I was looking at some of the laws, the cool laws, the country of origin laws. They change, and they're very mercurial. You can get something that's stamped USDA that actually came from out of the country, but it was processed or fabricated in the United States, so you don't really know the origin, even though you think you do. It's a big issue.
Yeah.
And he's genuinely on. If you're working in that commodity industrial system, it gets very hard, and a lot of people who are concerned about that, they switch over to the local system because then they can look the farmer in the eye and say, okay, I know.
The number here is 800-348-2551. Shannon Hayes is our guest from Sapbush Hollow Farm Cafe. And let's go to Adams, Massachusetts. Jim, you're on. Go ahead.
Yay, Ray. And yay, Shannon.
Hello.
Yes, I'd like to ask, I've heard that chicken eggs and chicken meat promote inflammation in the human body. If the chickens are raised, pasture-raised, and not fed grain every day of their lives, does that still hold true with the promotion of inflammation in the human body?
Oh, inflammation.
We thought you said information, and we thought, oh, Jim's going off the deep end. All right, so that's different. Okay, we got you.
Okay, so first of all, to raise a chicken, I'm going to tell you, without feeding them grain would create very unpalatable chicken because chickens are omnivores and they can't subsist on grass alone. So they can eat bugs. And that's why when you hear pasture-raised farmers, we call it pasture-raised. A chicken is not grass-fed by definition. We use the pasture to enhance the chicken's diet so that the chicken will eat less grain. But a chicken is going to be fed with grain, but when they're on the pasture, they're foraging. So they're getting more bugs, they're getting the grass as well, and they're getting a much more diverse diet, which dramatically reduces the amount of grain that the chicken is going to get. Now, how does that translate into inflammation? I suspect you're going to find a lot of nutritionists who are going to argue one way or the other, whether that contributes to inflammation, and I've heard people argue it. My experience is, and my understanding of the issue, is that while eating grains directly for some people might cause inflammation in the body, I don't think once it's gone through a chicken, it's really that much of an issue, except I have spoken with people who have celiac disease, who some people I've met say they have to stick to 100% grass-fed animals, which means they can't eat chicken. They need to stick to a ruminant that can have a 100% grass-fed diet.
Jim, thanks for the call. It's 800-348-2551. If you'd like to talk to Shannon Hayes, chef, CEO, big boss at Sap Bush Hollow Farm Cafe in Schoharie County, New York, 800-348-2551. Joyce is in Brattleboro, Vermont. Hello, Joyce.
Hi. I'm really excited to hear this program. As a naturopathic physician, I've been my sister's veterinarian, and my sister raises organically raised sheep up in Maine. And over the years, it's been a big problem because sheep are browsers with worms and parasites. And since you're raising so many sheep, I'm wondering, what do you do to deal with the issue of worms? When I was in Santa Fe, New Mexico, they had certified organic lamb, and they were the farmer said he was grazing his sheep on chaparral, and therefore he was able to deal with the worms. So that's my question. Mm-hmm. How do you deal with worms and parasites on your farm with the sheep?
Okay. So parasites in sheep are a real issue. And I have encountered a number of organic sheep farmers in particular who, you know, they try things, they try garlic, they try different things. You don't want your sheep to have a parasite infestation, but an organic farmer really wants to, you know, reduce the medications into the sheep. What we do on the farm is we do not certify as organic. We are a pasture-based farm, mm-hmm. but we do not certify as organic. And one of the reasons why we don't is because we do have a deworming protocol. But we use a system where we evaluate every single sheep individually. We have the sheep on a rotation where they start on one side of the farm, then they come down through the valley floor, mm-hmm. And a couple times during the growing season, we run every sheep through a chute. And I'm sure you've worked with this with your sister, where we actually look at the color of the eyes and we look for discoloration that indicates the severity of a parasite infection. And the reason why you do that is you let them, if it's a mild infection, you try to let the parasites that aren't too severe go ahead and live, so that you're basically selecting the parasites that aren't too bad. And then the ones that have severe infestations, then we do actually really use deworming, and we change those medications regularly, but we do it on a minimal basis. And I have to say, you know, you might find some organic sheep farmers who say they really don't have to do that. We have not felt that that was a safe protocol that we could enforce on our farm, and so we have chosen this method to use as little as possible and as conscientiously as possible.
Joyce.
Mm-hmm. Let me just mention that my area of expertise, I'm also a botanist, is seaweeds. And what my sister found on the farm in Miss Coastal, southern Maine, in Jefferson, is that she goes down and gets fresh seaweed, Escaphyllum brown seaweed, and the seaweed, feeding the sheep fresh seaweed, has done a huge amount for those ruminants.
I see.
That's fascinating. Well, I'm going to write that down. And
you are writing it down, but there isn't that much seaweed in Schoharie County. All right. Well, Joyce, thank you very much. 800-348-2551. So, I mean, what do you think that you would learn from that? Before you answer about the seaweed, and frankly, it's probably a moot point, What can you learn by looking at the eyes of the sheep? I mean, how can you tell? Are they red or what's up?
I would love to turn it over to my father who's in the studio.
Well, you know,
with me.
There's a microphone right in front of him if he wants to. You want to come on?
Yeah,
all right. So
this is here, a great person, Joyce.
Mike,
you are in for a treat.
What's your name, sir?
Jim.
Jim. All right, Jim, tell us about this. What can you learn by looking at the eyes of a sheep?
Okay, basically you look at the lower eyelid, and you're getting an idea of the hematocrit, how much blood is in there. One of the main parasites is Haemonchus contortus, which is a blood consumer. And so if they have a heavy dose of this, they're going to have a very pale eye. We also look at the nasal discharge for other forms of worms and their general, if they have any scours or anything like that before we deworm them. I would say that the best thing, though, is pasture management to control your parasites. On the farm, sheep are not on a particular pasture more than 2 days, and they don't return there to that pasture for 60 days. And therefore, and the length of the pasture which they return on, right, they don't graze down more closer than like 3 inches. And most of the worms can only migrate up a couple of inches. So that helps cut down on the exposure significantly. It's a real package, all right, to try and do it. And we also, animals that we consistently have to deworm, we will cull them from the flock because they don't have the immunity. It also, on the other hand, if you deworm every sheep every time they go through, all right, basically the ones that survive, the worms that survive, are
toughies.
You're selecting for virulence. So I'm out of here.
You can turn it off if you want. You can turn it off for now, Mike, but we might have to go back to Jim for just a little
bit.
Yeah,
it's PhD 1 and PhD 2.
So now I know why you're so brilliant. It makes perfect sense. The number here is 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. Elizabeth is in New Paltz. I believe she emailed, but she wants to talk. Elizabeth, go ahead.
Yeah, I did both.
Smart.
Yes. I have two questions. I started out with one question, and then you started talking about the chickens eating the bugs.
Right.
And I read a book by Michael Pollan, The Omnivore's Dilemma. He talks about a movable thing that he calls a tractor, so that there's different areas. First, they let the animals graze, so it puts down poop, which feeds the insects, and then the chickens eat the insects. Do you have that kind of device, or is it different? That's the one question.
Okay.
And then the other question I had, which was totally separate, was you mentioned about cooking, and I wanted to know if you change your cooking instruction based on new devices such as air fryers and induction cooktops.
That's a good question, too, but let's go with question one first. Shannon.
Okay. So we do we don't use chicken tractors, that particular technology. There's a lot of different ways of doing exactly what you described. We use our tractor for other things. We actually have these hoop houses that we have the chickens in that are surrounded by portable electric fencing that we use. And we pull those houses by hand to a new location each day to make sure that the chickens aren't soiling, you know, they're not eating any air in any grass areas where they've soiled, and also that leaves the concentrated fecal matter in the soil, which then helps the grass to regenerate. So yes, we use that system. We just happen to design one that we can pull with our hands so that we don't have to hook it up to a tractor every single time. And then new cooking methodologies. That's a great question. I'm a big fan of induction cooking myself. In fact, I prefer it over all others. However, living in rural Schoharie County, while I have an induction cooktop, I keep two cooktops in my kitchen. I keep one propane and one induction because when power goes out, the propane still does the job.
Yeah.
And
I absolutely agree with that. I would never want to get rid of my gas stove. But I don't use it because I use the induction cooktop, but it's nice to know that the gas range is there for when the power goes out.
Yeah, and the air fryers, I have some customers who have really tried to sell me on the air fryers, and I didn't get on board with them. I took a look and I was like, I don't want that thing on my counter. I don't want, you know, it's single purpose. I don't want it there. And then my daughter, my oldest daughter and her boyfriend started fiddling around with it. And darn, they turned out some really,
really
great meals. But what I found is the reason why I was kept pushing it aside is I never cook for two. I'm cooking for, you know, four, six, you know, whatever. And I,
so
everybody's
true.
Hungry. So I tended to avoid that technology. But I've started observing that when it is cooking for two or smaller, that's a really smart piece of tech for turning out some really tasty food.
Elizabeth, thanks a lot. We got to take a break here. Shannon Hayes is our guest from Sapbush Hollow Farm Cafe. 800-348-2551. Little Woody Herman for you. It's a Zappa tune, but it was Woody Herman from the early 70s. America drinks and goes home here on Vox Pop. 800-348-2551. Shannon Hayes is our guest from Sapbush Hollow Farm Cafe. And we have about a month to go until the cafe kicks it in. What are your hours?
Very limited.
That's what
They're
I thought.
Special.
I looked at the. By the way, the kitchen looks great. You have a picture on the website.
The hours are Saturdays 9 to 2. We're running from Memorial Day weekend until Halloween, and we're closed September 5th and 12th for a little vacation.
Are you the only cook?
Yeah. Well, when the cafe
disappointed.
I don't have a whole line back there, no.
No.
When the cafe's up and running, it's my husband and myself in the back, and he is really good about making things beautiful. I am very good about turning up food.
Yeah.
And so it's the two of us in the back, and that's it.
It has to be a somewhat limited menu since there are only two of you. What do you serve?
Well, we specialize in things that we've grown on the farm and that are grown right down the road. So the meat and vegetables and eggs are all coming right from within a couple miles. The dairy is a New York State local dairy as well. So what do we have? We have an espresso machine, and my neighbor up the road, he actually has a coffee roastery in Harlem, and he roasts all the coffee for the cafe. And we're one of these strange cafes where we don't serve alternative milks. Because
what do you mean, alternative
like
milks?
Almond milk, coconut milk, oat milk.
It's not really milk.
No, it's not. We just serve whole milk, and there are reasons for that, but we're not like a standard cafe. We really work with what's available and what's going to move through. So we have a full espresso bar, and then we gather the eggs from the hens during the week, and we use those to cook the egg dishes. You know, any eggs that you'd like to have that we'll cook them. I won't do poached, though. It just breaks down the kitchen when I have to do poached. My kitchen doesn't work for it, so please don't come and order poached.
Our guest today is Shannon Hayes from Sapbush Hollow Farm Cafe. And we talked a little bit about keeping the pastures sustained and thriving. Give me some of the things that you do that, to manage that, to make it sustainable.
Well, I'd like to turn that over
once again to Jim,
Dr. James Hayes over here, because I can certainly talk about it.
Yeah.
But he really is the guy in charge, and I'm in charge in the kitchen, and I'm in charge of the books, and I'm in charge of the money.
I don't know.
But when it comes to the livestock, I listen to Dad.
I don't know if I can afford to Jim Hayes here. You want to come back on for free for a minute? Let's turn his mic on again, Mike.
I could dock his pay.
Fair enough.
Okay.
So how do you keep that pasture sustainable and thriving?
All right. Well, we've managed pH on the soil. We are an upland farm, which tends to have a low pH, but we haven't had to add much lime. Our pasture rotation is probably the key thing.
Yeah.
All right. As far as having animals only on for a short period of time, not taking it out to ground level. All right.
When you say a short period of time?
2 days.
Okay.
1 to 2 days. When we separate the animals. They're in, you know, 1 to 2 acre pastures, depending on how many livestock are in there. And we use electric netting, all right, to keep them there. And then we move them constantly. And that they tend to fertilize a little bit better because they're in a broader area. And they also give the animal, gives the plant enough time to regenerate.
Do you seed or do you just let it go naturally?
What? The pastures we will go through and we will go through once, all right, and we will just put the animals in there and they will eat for 2 days and then the first time through it will get a bit ahead of them and we just let them trample it down. And we may mow that, you know, or we may not depending on what's going on in the pasture if we're getting a lot of woody plants or something like that. But it's the pasture rotation system that, uh-huh. that really does it. And we will spread some composted manure on it every few years. But that's about it. There's no fertilizer. You know, we're not worried about the Strait of Hormuz right now.
Right? We'll talk about fertilizer. That's a good point.
Okay. And we, you know, it's a natural growth. We will also, in the spring, we will go around and we will, depending on what the field is, we will frost seed a little bit. We will throw some clover seed out at the end of winter, and that helps add legumes to the population and therefore nitrogen fixation.
I think your daughter wants to jump in here, but just one question. How long have you been at this game?
I'm almost 80 years old, all right?
Yeah.
And we've been, I've owned sheep since I was 3, yeah. So it's a long time.
Good life?
Yeah, we've done a lot of different things, but we've always had some, as my father would say, agriculture has always been part of our portfolio.
Fair enough. All right, now, Shannon, you wanted to jump in.
I was just going to answer that question about the seed specifically. You know, when you picture farmers with seed, you know, I think a lot of people have an industrial view of like this is a big industrial thing. Now, this is dad running around with a mule with a bag of seed on the back and
not
a hand
a mule,
scatterer.
Not a little mule.
You know, a 4x4 vehicle. I mean, this is a very small seeding that we do. You know, you just go out and say, okay, there's some bare ground over there. There's some bare ground over
right.
here. It's not like a big, you know, we don't till. We don't do anything.
We don't have any view of weeds either. There's a lot of things that the sheep will eat, which are very tolerable and very have good nutritional value. And we give them those too, so.
All right, Dave writes in from Pittsfield, Massachusetts. I grew up on a farm outside of Pittsfield, and when oat milk and almond milk and everything else started coming out, my father would get so irritated. Milk comes from mammals, sheep, goats, cows, humans. Oat milk is just processed oats steeped in water, some chemicals added. Same with almond milk. I just wish they would find another word for it. I don't care what people want to put in their coffee or cereal or what have you, although I'm partial to whole milk. But milk is milk, says Dave, and that other stuff is water with whatever mixed in. Hold your ground, says Dave.
Well, thank you. There's also a very simple economic reason, too. Because we are extremely rural, I don't have the foot traffic that a normal cafe is and that a normal cafe gets. Which is one of the reasons why we're only open one day a week, because I have to be able to move enough people through. But also, you know, if I serve 50 or 60 people in a day and only one of them wants oat milk, if I open up a container of oat milk, then I have to dump it all down the drain at the end of the day. So there are simple economics, but you're right. I could totally get preachy about, you know, what's the origin? Is there palm oil in that? I could do that. For a while, my daughters, when people would come in, and sometimes people really are not pleased when we don't have their specific milk. Particularly if they don't believe in eating animal products. But my daughters, for a while, they were saying, if they would get asked, well, why don't you have almond milk? And they would just look at the customer and say, well, have you heard about the wildfires in California?
Ooh, good answer. Yeah, that's smart. All right.
But, you know, there is a simple economic reason that a small cafe like ours just can't sustain that. But we can act like it's a political thing and that we know more than others, too, if we want.
Well, that's all right. You know, and the economics of the whole thing are tough. And Jim mentioned the Strait of Hormuz. Fertilizer the costs are skyrocketing like so many other things.
Yeah. This is a really interesting issue. I'll tell you, the price of corn has not gone up yet. We don't know if it's going to go up. And that's actually more disconcerting. And it's like It's the subtext that we're not hearing in the story that has me worried.
Because Explain.
Because there are farmers all across the country. Most of our feed is coming in locally, but fertilizer is an issue for all of them.
Yep.
And feed prices are determined based on the futures market, and it's a commodity system. But when farmers have this expense right now, this incredible expense that they're having to put on, well, the price of feed right now, the price of corn is actually low because we have a backstock. There's a surplus of corn. So these farmers aren't getting what they need. And we're all talking about the price of feed and how's that going to impact our food. I think the bigger story is if these farmers can't recover their expenses, what's that going to do to the farmers that we're going to lose, whether they're industrial commodity family farms or whether they're little local hippie pasture-raised organic farms like ours? It's still the loss of an industry, and we have to be really thinking about those individuals. As far as what's going to happen at Sapbush, we could use a crystal ball maybe, but what we're trying to do is actually raise a little bit of a surplus right now, and we did this during the pandemic too, have a little bit of a surplus on hand. And then we expect that the prices are going to get higher at the start of the next growing season where we might see it come through.
Yeah.
And so we're hoping to ride that out with surplus product. It's nice when you can freeze your product.
Our guest today is Shannon Hayes of Sapbush Hollow Farm Cafe and her dad, Jim, too. He's been jumping in here from time to time. 800-348-2551. If you want to get in here toward the tail end of the program with a question or two, you can email voxpop@wamc.org. You talked about little hippie run farms, and it's funny but true. And there have been a lot of farms that have disappeared across the country. For you, as someone who runs the show, is it important ideologically for you to fight it out? I mean, there are real estate interests that would grab farms. There are big industrial farms that would grab. Do you make your stand with this?
I'm actually going to tell you, it's no longer an ideological issue. I can totally make a stand on an ideological issue, but I actually think I'm providing, in my heart and soul, the best possible future for my children, which is why I hold on. I do not have the kind of income that a tech bro would have. It's very, very low, but I want for nothing. I live very, very comfortably. And my daughters, they're both getting their associate's degree this spring. And I see them looking out in the world and recognizing that the assets, the resources, the quality of life, and the freedom that we have, they're not going to get when they go to other places. So I actually would argue that I'm holding on because I got something good.
I love that. And that is the best answer I have heard in a long time. Larry is in Ancrum Dale. Larry, go ahead. You're on with Shannon Hayes.
Yeah, Shannon and Dr. Hayes. I just want to reminisce a little bit. Remember the Farmer's Ball up in Saratoga with Billy Best and Kathy Ross? And I remember visiting your place and your first book. And it's just great to hear you both on the phone. I raised grass-fed organic beef for 22 years with British Whites and Murray Grays. I appreciate what you're doing, and it sounds like you've read Serviceberry by Robin Wall Kimmerer, which talks about giving back, which is what you're doing, and I congratulate you, and it's great to hear you. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Larry. I did read Serviceberry. I've read a couple of things by Robin Wall Kimmerer. I love her work. I do have to say that I think the ethos of how we live has gone longer than those publications. I think this is, I'm a product of the land of Schoharie County. I'm a product of the neighbors who helped to raise me and my parents and grandparents. We just have a very, very long history of this. And I think that's even more remarkable that it's just bred into our DNA where we're coming from.
Larry, thank you. Okay, 800-348-2551. Only a couple of minutes left here. Go back to the grass-fed for a moment you just mentioned. Didn't you mention that the chickens will get grain as
yes.
well? why grass for the pasture-raised meats? I mean,
oh, that's an interesting question. Yeah. Why give them grass at all?
No, no, no. But and I don't know anything about this. Okay. But don't you add grain to fatten them up?
To fatten them up. Oh, okay. So why grain to grass-fed meat?
Instead of strictly pasture-raised mm-hmm. grass meat, why don't? Isn't it a cost-effective thing to add grain?
Okay, so there's grain fattening, and I would say then there's grain sustaining. And I would argue that grain fattening is not cost-effective at all.
Interesting.
And in fact, people who are buying their beef through the industrial commodity system and they're seeing their prices go out of control, that is just one of the reasons why. Because grain on a massive scale is very hard to sustain, particularly when you're dealing with like beef and sheep who are ruminants who were not actually designed to exist wholly on grain. Mm. So it's an expense that is not necessary. Why would you bring the feed to the animal if the animal has the ability to walk and browse and eat the feed and eat its own feed and then, you know, basically operate on sunshine and water and then incorporate that into their body, and then through that movement, then they build up the muscle integrity that gives them their species specific flavor. So you're getting a better quality product. Now, I want to say the grass-fed movement, a lot of times being purist on anything is not a good idea, because particularly as farmers are learning to negotiate climate issues, we've been in a drought for a while. And I'll get letters from grass farmers up in Manitoba who've been dealing with the drought even longer. A good farmer is not going to religiously adhere to whatever the dictates that humans want at any given time. A good farmer is going to watch the livestock and is going to make a decision. Sometimes feed is necessary. Sometimes the feed, because you couldn't get a high enough quality hay crop in there that the animal can't sustain itself, you do what the animal needs to keep the animal healthy. But grain finishing, where you're throwing them in a feedlot and just, you know, pumping that down their gullet, which is an unnatural system, you're messing with the biota, you're messing with the acidity in their stomachs, you're creating all kinds of problems because the animal wasn't meant to eat that. That's just, to me, undue expense that is not sustainable.
Can you tell the difference when you sit down at the table, oh, this is grain-fed beef, this is grass-fed beef?
I've had some very embarrassing situations where that has come across. I've been, you know, I've traveled around the country teaching cooking workshops, and sometimes they put on like these nice fancy events and I'll have meat come in and I'll have people all signed up for the workshop and I'll take a taste of the meat and I'll stop. I've stopped
really
everything and said, this isn't the real thing. We got to switch this out.
All right. Well, we're done here. Shannon Hayes, man, it's great having you on the show. And thanks for bringing your cohort here, Dr. James.
My partner in crime.
How do people find out more about Sapbush Hollow Farm?
They can go visit the website, sapbushfarmstore.com, and you can learn all about all of us and the cafe and the podcast where I got my start from WAMC to bring us right around again.
We are so happy that you got a start and that you're back with us, and we'll have you back again if you want to come.
Absolutely.
Support comes from Berkshire Agricultural Ventures with their Market Watch Fund to help support local farmers, farmers markets, and families in need. BerkshireAgVentures.org. And Hancock Shaker Village celebrating spring with the Baby Animal Festival through May 10th. Lambs, piglets, calves, chicks, baby goats, plus craft demonstrations and tours of the historic buildings. HancockShakerVillage.org. Once again, thanks to Shannon Hayes and Dr. James Hayes for being here today from Sapbush Hollow Farm Cafe. Thanks to Mike Bowen, our engineer. It's almost the weekend, brother. Thanks to Barb King, who screened the calls. Thank you, Barb. I'm Ray Graff. Thanks for being with us on the show today. We'll be back on Monday. Have a great weekend.